delivered her message, Your Majesty. We really do have those formalities to deal with, I'm afraid. His head twitched ever so slightly, indicating the gorgeously clad ranks of aristocrats, some of whose expressions seemed just a bit less welcoming than his own, standing behind him at a respectful distance on the jam-packed quay. Will you come and meet your Chisomian subjects? Welcome heat poured from the vast fireplace to Queen Mother Alana Tate's left as she sat at the foot of the table, gazing up its length across the glittering silver and polished glass and china at the dark-haired young man sitting at the table's head. For the past several months, that chair, the one at the table's head, had been Alana's, and it felt odd to see someone else sitting in it. Especially this someone else, she thought. It wouldn't bother me a bit to see Charlie sitting there again. She watched Emperor Caleb turn his head, laughing at something Baron Green Mountain had said, and she discovered that her eyes were examining his profile intensely. It was as if by staring at him she could somehow have a glimpse of her daughter once again. Then, without warning, Caleb stopped laughing at Green Mountain's comment and looked straight at her, and she found her eyes gazing directly into his. They were dark in the lamplight, those eyes, dark and deep and surprisingly warm, almost gentle. Odd. Gentle was the one adjective it would never have occurred to her to apply to the victor of Rock Point, of Crag Hook, and Darkos Sound. And yet it was the only one which really fitted. The young man sitting in her daughter's chair met her gaze directly, not challengingly, but with understanding, with compassion. A peculiar little tingle danced somewhere deep inside her at the thought. It was as if in that moment she had finally allowed herself to realize, or at least to admit, something she'd refused to face directly from the moment Caleb's proposal of matrimony arrived in Chiraeth. Fear. Fear that the man who'd won those smashing victories, who'd threatened to sink every one of the Earl of Thirsk's ships without quarter or mercy, unless his surrender terms were accepted, must be as hard as his reputation, as cold as the sword at his side. Fear that her daughter had gone to wed a man as merciless in his own way as the kraken which was the emblem of his house. It wasn't that she'd feared Caleb might be evil, the monster of depravity depicted in the Group of Four's propaganda. But a man need not be evil to be cold, to recognize all of the ways in which political calculation must trump mere human emotions when the prize was the life or death of entire kingdoms, and to act accordingly. But she wasn't seeing that man. Oh, she had no doubt that a man with that chin, those eyes, which had seen too much blood and death already for a man of twice his years, could be just as hard and cold as any steel blade. Whatever else he might be, Caleb Armok was no weakling, no captive to indecision or to vacillation. Yet who she was seeing in this moment was the young man, the husband, Charlian's letters had described. Not the Emperor, not the invincible Admiral, or merciless dictator of terms, or leader of schism against God's Church, but her daughter's husband. Oh, my God, a quiet voice said softly, almost prayerfully, in the back of her mind. Charlie wasn't just trying to reassure me. She was telling me the truth. She truly loves him. And maybe even more important, he truly loves her. Alana Tate had watched her daughter sacrifice too much already on the altar of responsibility, give too much to the weight of the crown she had been forced to assume when other girls were still playing with dolls, surrender too many of the joys which should have been hers. Charlian had never complained, never wasted effort on self-pity, or admitted she missed those things, yet Alana had missed them for her. In the lonely watches of the night, she had prayed for her daughter's happiness, begged God to give her some small scrap of personal love and joy as partial compensation for all of the cold, demanding prestige, power, and wealth of her queenship. Surely God could not have condemned her to a bitter, cold marriage after all he had already demanded of her. Yet that was exactly what Alana had feared. And if Charlian had never admitted it, her mother had known it was what she feared as well. Now, for just an instant, the Queen Mother's lips trembled, and then, to her astonished embarrassment, she burst into totally unanticipated tears. Green Mountain rose quickly, stepping urgently around to her, going to one knee beside her chair, and taking her right hand in both of his, and she heard his soft, urgent questions. Heard him asking her why she wept, but she couldn't answer him. She could only stare down the length of the table at the young man who had so unexpectedly, without saying a single word, told her that her daughter had found the one thing in the world her mother had most feared she would never know. Caleb Armagh watched Queen Mother Alana weep, listened to Green Mountain speaking softly and urgently to her. He'd been as surprised as Charlian's first counselor by the Queen Mother's tears, but only for a moment. Only until he'd recognized the way her eyes clung to him, even through her tears, and recognized that the one thing in which she did not weep was sorrow. He patted his mouth with his napkin, laid the snowy linen aside, and pushed back his own chair. At his express request, he, Alana, and Green Mountain were dining privately. Even the servants had withdrawn, waiting to be summoned by the ringing of Queen Mother Alana's bell if they were needed. Even Merlin Athrawis stood outside the private dining chamber's door, guarding the privacy of all its occupants, and now Caleb went to one knee at the other side of Alana's chair. He took her free hand in his own, raised it to his lips, and kissed its back gently, then looked up at her. Or rather across, for he was as tall kneeling as she was sitting. "Your Grace," he murmured, "I feared the same thing myself in many ways." "Feared, Your Majesty?" Alana repeated, and he nodded, then reached up with his left hand. A gentle thumb brushed tears from her cheek, and he smiled softly, almost sadly. "You feared your daughter had been caught in a trap," he told her. "You were afraid of a loveless marriage of state, a thing of cold calculation and ambition. From what Charlian's told me, I believe you recognized the reasons for that calculation, understood the necessity behind the ambition, but still you feared them, as did I. I had reports of your daughter, descriptions. I knew her history, but I didn't know her. And I was afraid, so afraid, that if she accepted my proposal, I would be condemning both of us to a necessary but loveless union. That, like so many other princes and princesses, kings and queens, we would be forced to sacrifice our own hopes of happiness on the altar of duty to our crowns. Charlian changed that for me. She changed it by being someone I could love, and someone who could love me, by being as brave, as warm and loving as she was intelligent, as compassionate as she was pragmatic, as gentle as she could be ruthless at need. I would have proposed this marriage no matter what her character might have been, and I would have wed her with all honor, even if there'd been no love at all between us, just as she would have wed me. But God was good to us. We had no need to make that choice, because we truly do love one another. I wish, more than I could ever possibly say, that she were here to tell you that herself. She can't be. God in his mercy may have spared us from a cold, unfeeling marriage, yet our other duties, our other responsibilities remain. and it would be impossible for Charlian, as I know I need not tell you, to leave those responsibilities unmet, those duties undone. You and Baron Greenmountain taught her that, just as my father taught me, and neither of us will be unworthy of our teachers.
I know, Alanna half-whispered. I know, Your Majesty, truly. And I see now that Charlie's letters told me nothing but the simple truth when I feared she was trying desperately to offer me false comfort. Forgive me, Your Majesty, but I half suspected, feared at least, that the true reason she hadn't accompanied you home to Chiraeth was that it was a loveless marriage, and you feared I might realize that when I finally saw the two of you together.
Your Grace, I told you Charlian would never lie to you about something like that, Greenmountain said softly, and she gave him a watery smile.
Dear Marek, she pulled her hand out of his to touch him lightly on one cheek. Of course you did. I know that. Just as I fully realize that you would lie Shanwei out of hell if that was what it took to protect Charlian or me.
Your Grace, I never, he began, only to have her interrupt him with a soft gurgle of laughter.
Of course you would have, and don't make it worse by trying to convince me otherwise.
He looked at her with an oddly hopeless expression, and she laughed again, then turned her attention back to Caleb.
Get up, Your Majesty. It's not fitting that you should be on your knees to me.
Her voice, Caleb noticed, was much stronger than it had been, with a scolding note he had not previously heard from her. It was one he recognized, though. The last time he'd heard it, from someone besides Charlian herself, at least, it had been from his own mother, and he felt something warm within his heart.
"Yes, Your Grace, immediately, Your Grace. To hear is to obey, Your Grace," he said meekly, brown eyes twinkling with devilish delight, and she laughed again.
"That's quite enough of that, too, Your Majesty," she told him. "You aren't going to turn me up sweet with a few words and an easy smile. That may have worked with my young and impressionable daughter, sir, but it won't work with me."
"Your Grace, I am shocked. Shocked, I say, that you could possibly impute such base motives to me."
"Of course you are," she said dryly, then pointed firmly with her free hand at the chair he had abandoned.
He held her left hand a moment longer, still smiling at her, then rose and walked obediently around to seat himself once more in the indicated chair.
"With all due respect, Your Majesty," she continued, "I hope you'll forgive me if I inform you that you are a charming, utterly unprincipled young rascal. No doubt you've found that smile of yours has always gotten you out of trouble before. I suspect you'll find it rather less effective in my own case, however."
Well, there went all my hopes and plans to use my irresistible charm to steer you into doing things my way.
"Somehow," Green Mountain said, his tone even drier than the Queen Mother's, "I rather doubt that you've resorted to anything as uncertain as irresistible charm in quite some time, Your Majesty."
"Indeed not," Alanna agreed, her eyes narrowing as she considered the exotically dressed young man sitting at the far end of the table.
"Mind you, it's already obvious to me that you can be quite charming when it suits you, Your Majesty. And to be frank, if I were 20 years or so younger, I would undoubtedly find that charm almost as irresistible as Charlian obviously has. In my own case, however, you have something much more valuable and convincing."
"I do."
Caleb arched one eyebrow, his head cocked politely, and she snorted.
"Of course you do," she said in a much more serious tone.
"You have the truth, and you have the partnership you and Charlian have obviously forged. I already knew that much from her letters."
And does the rest of Chisholm share that belief with you, Your Grace? Caleb asked softly.
Not all of it, Your Majesty, Green Mountain answered for the Queen Mother. Not all of it, but for most of your people, most of Queen Charlian's subjects, there's more than enough trust in her and her judgment to offset the fears of those who don't agree, for now at least.
That was the impression we'd both drawn from your letters to her, my lord, Caleb said, carefully never mentioning the reports he'd had from one Merlin Athrawes as well.
I hope this visit will help to convince at least some of those stubborn holdouts that their fears are groundless.
If you mean our own temple loyalists are going to find it a bit difficult to continue describing you as Shanwe come back to Safehold, complete with horns, cloven hooves, and hairy tail, you're probably right, Green Mountain replied dryly. On the other hand, I'm sure you don't need me to point out that where power and politics are concerned, most men really don't need Mother Church to inspire them with distrust, especially if they scent the possibility of siphoning some of that power into their own hands.
The fact that you left Charlie at home in Telisburg, trusted her at your back, with all of the levers of power in your own kingdom, is going to go a long way towards reassuring those whose concerns were genuine, Your Majesty, Alana said. And frankly, the fact that Marak and I accept your authority, not to mention taking both you and Charlie at your word when you claim to be true partners and co-equals, is going to be just as reassuring. Unfortunately, mere reassurance isn't going to inspire the ambitious to suddenly abandon their own designs. Nor, her eyes darkened, is it going to magically convince those temple loyalists Marak just mentioned to acquiesce in your blasphemous defiance of Mother Church.
Perhaps not, Caleb agreed calmly, sitting back in his chair, the comfortably upholstered, ornately carved chair in which Charlian had sat so many nights, before the softly roaring fire. The priceless emeralds set into the golden chain about his neck danced with hearts of green fire as he fingered it, and he smiled.
Perhaps not. On the other hand, when all of the Carisian sailors and marines I brought with me come ashore and begin telling Charlian's people how she already has every single one of my subjects eating out of her hand, I suspect those temple loyalists of yours may find it just a bit more difficult to foment distrust. And I'd imagine that all the marks they're going to be spending in your taverns and taprooms, not to mention your brothels, if you'll pardon me for bringing that up, will make them rather more welcome visitors. Which, of course, his smile grew thinner, baring his teeth, and this time Queen Mother Alana felt a profound satisfaction as she saw in it all of the cold steel and ruthlessness she'd been so afraid of seeing such a short time before, completely leaves aside the fact that if any of your temple loyalists or ambitious nobles should have been cherishing any notions about challenging Charlian's decision to link Chisholm's fate with that of Karis, it's just remotely possible that finding 40 or 50,000 Carisian marines in the vicinity will cause them to rethink their options, shall we say.
Oh, I believe it's entirely possible you're correct about that, Your Majesty, Green Mountain said with a satisfaction which matched Alana's own. And, in the meantime, he continued with a smile, might I tempt you to sample just a little more of this truly excellent chicken?
2. Royal Dockyard, City of Chiraeth, Kingdom of Chisholm.
Thank you, Commander Osmond, Captain André Gerard said as the Chisholmian officer behind the desk signed off on the requisition order for replacement spars. Properly speaking, Gerard ought to have left this interview to his purser,
A full captain, the commanding officer of one of the Imperial Carizian Navy's most powerful galleons, had far better things to do with his time than to spend it hobnobbing with dockyard officers just because he wanted a few spare spars before heading off to conduct an invasion. And if that was true of most galleon skippers, it was especially true of the man who commanded Emperor Caleb's flagship. Handling routine chores like this one so that their captains didn't have to was precisely the reason the Navy had pursers in the first place.
"You're welcome, Captain Gerard," the Chisomian said, setting his pen back into its desktop holder as he looked up from the document with a smile. "At least this is one requisition I can be certain is going to end up where it's supposed to end up, rather than on the black market somewhere."
Gerard chuckled, although, truth to tell, he wasn't certain whether or not Commander Osmond truly had been making a joke. Prior to Chisholm's involuntary participation in the Group of Four's attack on Karis, the Royal Chisholmian Navy had been fighting a losing battle against corruption and peculation. Certain of its officers, secure behind the protection of highly placed aristocratic patrons, had been far more interested in finding ways to line their own pockets than with safeguarding their Navy's combat readiness. All sorts of vital supplies had mysteriously disappeared, and all too often, officers who'd tried to do something about it had paid a stiff price in highly placed aristocratic enemies. So it was entirely possible that this particular Chisholmian was referring to the sweeping reforms which had been rammed through his own navy by the Earl of Sharpfield, its senior officer, as part of the Navy's mobilization before his departure for Emerald and the Battle of Darkos Sound. Any truly competent officer must have welcomed those reforms, after all. There was another possibility, however, and that second possibility helped to explain why Gerard had come to deal with this matter in person. Much of Safehold accepted the stereotype of the Kingdom of Karis as a kingdom of moneylenders and shopkeepers, populated by greedy, scheming Carizians who were always on the lookout for ways to squeeze a mark out of any opportunity which came their way. There was an enormous amount of unspoken envy in that stereotype, of course, but that made it no less real. And there were more than a few Safeholdians who would have added unscrupulous, dishonest, and shifty to all the other adjectives. After all, if they hadn't been unscrupulous, dishonest, and shifty, then they wouldn't have been so much wealthier than those far more worthy souls who cherished the stereotype in the first place. Since the invasion fleet had arrived in Cherry Bay, its Carizian officers had encountered quite a few people who obviously shared that stereotypical view of them.
"Seriously, sir," Osmond said, "it's been a privilege to be able to supply your requirements." And his eyes hardened ever so slightly. "I, for one, was delighted to have the opportunity to do it, especially here."
Those no longer smiling eyes met Gerard's, and Caleb's flag captain felt himself relax internally. Not everyone in what had been the Royal Chisholmian Navy before its merger into the new Imperial Carizian Navy would have shared Kenai Osmond's opinion on this particular subject. The invasion fleet's decision to bypass Kraken Bay, where the city of Port Royal had been built almost a century ago expressly to serve as the Navy's primary base, to anchor in Cherry Bay, so much farther to the north, might not have been the most subtle possible way to deliver a message, but it had certainly been effective. The incredible mass of galleons anchored off Chisholm's capital city, and especially the 50,000 Imperial Carizian Marines embarked aboard the transports, was something not even the most ambitious Chisholmian aristocrat could overlook. As pointed suggestions went, this one was more pointed than most. and those who had found the greatest personal advantage under the old system had understood exactly who had been intended to absorb that point.
"I'm glad you feel that way, Commander," Gerard said now. "And I have been impressed by the professionalism you and most of the other dockyard officers have displayed."
"It's been a relief able to display it," Osman said, with rather more frankness than Gerard had expected, even now. "I won't pretend that anyone in the Navy was happy about what you Carizians did to us at Darkos Sound."
His mouth tightened briefly, and his eyes darkened, but then he shook himself and his mouth relaxed.
"On the other hand, it wasn't exactly like you'd been left a lot of choice, was it? Most of us understood that, too. The ones of us who could think, at least. And," he bared his teeth in a tight smile, "since Earl Sharpset got home, those of us who found that difficult to understand seem to have been finding ourselves with quite a lot of, free time on our hands."
The Chisomian's dust-dry tone was so biting, Gerard snorted in amusement. Sharpset had returned to Chisholm with the surrendered galleys Emperor Caleb, although he'd been King Caleb at the time, of course, had spontaneously returned to Chisholm even before he had proposed marriage to Chisholm's queen. Since the Earl's return, and especially since Queen Charlian had accepted Caleb's proposal, Sharpset had attacked the twin problems of his own navy's lingering corruption and the challenge of preparing for the merger of the Chisomian and Carizian fleets with vigor. In the process, quite a few Chisomian officers had found themselves abruptly turfed out of their comfortable, profitable assignments. At the same time, those of them who appeared to be prepared to resist the merger had also found themselves summarily relieved of duty.
"Fair's fair, Commander," the flag captain replied after a moment. "Most Carizians understand how little choice Chisholm had about obeying the group of four's commands. We know it wasn't your idea to attack us, and most of us deeply regret how many of your people were killed or wounded in someone else's war. At the same time, I won't pretend there aren't also Carizians who aren't exactly prepared to simply forgive and forget. And, by the oddest happenstance, those officers who share that attitude seem to be finding themselves with quite a bit of unanticipated free time of their own."
"I thought that was probably the case, sir."
Osman's swivel chair creaked gently as he leaned back slightly.
"In fact, I didn't see how it could be any other way, to be honest."
"No, it couldn't be," Gerard agreed. "People are people. Some of them aren't going to be able to put the past behind them no matter what. It doesn't even mean they aren't trying to sometimes. It's just the way it is. So it's not really hard to understand why some officers would be uncomfortable with all the changes coming at them, even completely disregarding all of the religious implications."
He watched Osman's eyes as he spoke, but the Chisomian only nodded.
"You're right about that one, sir," he shrugged. "I don't think anyone in Chisholm, except maybe Her Majesty and Baron Green Mountain, ever expected things to come to a head with the group of four this way. It really hasn't helped smooth the way for our navy to combine with yours either."
He paused and frowned for a moment, then shook his head.
"Actually, that's not quite true," he said. "It's created problems with a lot of people, of course. I think we've probably got more temple loyalists here in Chisholm than you have in Karis for a lot of reasons. But for other people, it's actually helped."
He looked back into Gerard's eyes once more.
"Carizians aren't the only ones who could see what was happening in Zion, you know."
"Yes, I do know," Gerard nodded.
"Well, sir, I won't say that anyone here in Chisholm is doing handsprings of delight at the prospect of open warfare with Mother Church. But you might be surprised by how many of us already agreed with you schismatic Carizians, at least in principle.
And once Her Majesty decided to marry the Emperor, well...
He broke off with another, much more eloquent shrug, and Gerard nodded once more. Charlian's nobles might have been, or at least wanted to be, more fractious than Caleb's, but the flag captain had come to the conclusion that she'd been even more beloved by Chisholm's commoners than King Harald had been by their Carizian counterparts before his death. That was saying quite a lot, and that deep reservoir of trust and devotion had carried her people with her. It also helped to explain why Caleb's demonstration that she truly was his co-ruler, not simply his consort, had legitimized his own authority in their eyes, as probably nothing else could possibly have accomplished.
"Tell me, Commander Osmond," Gerard said, asking the question he'd had no intention of explicitly voicing when he came ashore for this meeting. "How do you think your fellow Chisholmians feel about Carizians now?"
"Now, sir," Osmond chuckled, "they still think every single one of you is out to turn a fast mark, and to be honest, I think many of us are more than a little uneasy about all these changes, all these new weapons and ways of doing things you seem intent on introducing. Certainly, when you first arrived, most people here in Chiraeth were bracing themselves just a bit. They expected an onslaught of money changers, loan krakens, and political hangers-on out to make a profit out of Chisholm. I think that despite everything, there were people who believed the Emperor's marriage proposal was really only a ploy designed to let Karis get its hands on everything worth having here in Chisholm. That much, at least, is changing. Or that's the way it seems to me, at any rate. I could be wrong, of course."
He twitched his shoulders in another brief shrug.
"From where I sit, though, I think that what the Emperor's had to say so far, coupled with the fact that he's made absolutely no political changes here in Chiraeth, hasn't brought in any of his own political favorites from home and handed them plum assignments, and the fact that he and Baron Greenmountain and the Queen Mother are obviously on such excellent terms, really has turned most of that suspicion around. The fact that your sailors and marines have been spending so freely hasn't hurt anything either. I haven't heard any of the dockside tavern keepers complaining, at any rate. Mind you, I can think of quite a few lords and ladies who probably don't like the new arrangement a bit, but that's more than offset, I think at least, by how much the common folk have been reassured. They've always regarded the Queen, the Empress, I mean, as one of their own, someone they can trust to look out for them. Now most of them seem willing to at least tentatively accept that the Emperor feels the same way she does. And I think we've at least reached a point where all but the most dyed-in-the-wool temple loyalists are willing to wait to hear his address to Parliament before they really decide what they think of him. If he says, what I rather suspect he's going to say, that trust in Her Majesty is going to attach itself to him, provisionally at least, and they'll decide they can trust him too."
"I certainly hope you're right, Commander," Gerard said quietly. "And it's true, you know. His Majesty does feel the same way Her Majesty does, although, to be honest, the battle lines between the common folk and the nobility are less sharply drawn in Karis."
"Really?"
Osmond cocked his head to one side, lips pursed.
"I'd heard that that was the case, sir," he continued after a moment. "From my perspective, it's a bit difficult to really accept, though. It's so different from the way things have been here in Chisholm for as long as anyone can remember."
"Well, Commander," André Gerard said, sitting back in his own chair with a smile as tight as anything Osmond had produced, "we'll just have to see what we can do about changing that, won't we? The Emperor has a saying, 'If it isn't broken, don't fix it.'
I'd say that's probably one of the main reasons he and Her Majesty haven't set out to make any political changes here in Jiraeth. Baron Greenmountain and Queen Mother Alana are doing just fine. But if anyone thinks His Majesty is going to be any more tolerant than Her Majesty were great nobles with delusions of grandeur, shall we say, are concerned, they're sadly mistaken.
Really? Osmond repeated, then smiled back at his Carizian visitor. Somehow, sir, I can't quite seem to find it in my heart to regret that. Odd, isn't it?
3. Parliament Hall, City of Jiraeth, Kingdom of Chisholm.
It's a good thing Charlian warned me, Caleb thought wryly, as he and his mounted bodyguard arrived outside Parliament Hall. Chisholm's Parliament had a much more magnificent home than its Carizian equivalent. Unfortunately, that owed rather more to the Chisholmian nobility's delusions of grandeur and appetite for power than it did to any reverence for popular participation in the kingdom's government. The sprawling building's windows flashed back the cold northern sunlight, and its white marble gleamed like chilled alabaster under a sky of palest blue, burnished with a few high puffs of cloud. The kingdom's banner snapped and popped from two of the flagstaffs above it, flanking the tallest central staff, which bore the banner of the new Carizian Empire. The traditional black field and golden kraken of Caris, quartered with the blue and white checkerboard of Chisholm. An icon of the Archangel Langhorne in his role as lawgiver crowned the roof above the hall's portico, scepter raised in stern benediction and admonition. Gold leaf glittered, and deep, detailed bas-relief sculptures decorated the hall's enormous bronze doors. Doors whose sculptures, by the strangest turn of fate, seemed oddly dominated by heroically posed nobles on their prancing chargers, with precious few peasants, merchants, sailors, mechanics, or manufactory owners anywhere to be seen.
The more I see, the more impressed I am that she managed to survive, much less retain her throne, Caleb thought much more soberly, as he took in the monument to the aristocracy's traditional domination of political power here in Chisholm. He'd always known the political equation in Chisholm was fundamentally different from the one in Caris. He hadn't realized before becoming privy to the Brethren of St. Gernot's hidden influence just why Caris was so different from so many other kingdoms and principalities. But he'd always realized that commonly born Carizians had far more say than commoners in other lands when it came to the way in which they were ruled. Chisholm had been one of those other lands, at least until Charlian's father had taken the throne. The Chisholmian aristocracy had secured a firm grip on the levers of power when a not-quite-rebellious alliance of his most powerful nobles forced Charlian's great-grandfather, Erwain II, to graciously grant the Charter of Jiraeth. According to Merlin, the terms imposed upon the crown at Jiraeth had been similar to those of something called the Magna Carta back on Old Earth, except that they'd been substantially more restrictive of the crown's prerogatives. The situation probably still wouldn't have been irretrievable except for the unhappy, from the crown's perspective at least, fact that her grandfather, Erwain III, had been a well-meaning but weak monarch. Charlian had once told Caleb that her grandfather would have made a truly excellent minor baron back in the hills somewhere, but he'd been a disaster as a reigning king. Instead of regaining the ground his father had lost, Erwain III had sought compromise rather than conflict. He'd dreaded the thought of what open warfare would have cost his subjects, and refused to inflict it upon them in defense of royal prerogatives.
and so he'd seen the nobility make even more inroads into the king's authority. By the time he died, the great nobles had reduced him to little more than a figurehead. Unfortunately, from the great magnate's perspective at least, however, they hadn't quite completed the process at the time of his death, and Charlian's father, King Salis, had been made of sterner stuff. The fact that he'd grown to young manhood, watching his own father's humiliation as he kept steadily losing ground, had probably had something to do with it, but he'd also been aware that factionalism among his nobles threatened to split Chisholm into warring fragments. That civil war would soon inflict all the bloodshed and horrors his father had bartered away the crown's authority, trying desperately to avoid, unless he made it his business to prevent it. He did, and he'd found the two men whose support he needed to accomplish his seemingly hopeless task. Merak Sondiers had been Salis's chief advisor and confidant, but the king had been ably assisted by his future brother-in-law, the Duke of Halbrook Hollow, as well. Erwain III had been stripped of everything the nobility recognized as a source of power, but he'd retained his status as the head of state, and the crown had retained the power to summon and dissolve Parliament. When the old king died, and Crown Prince Salis assumed the throne, the law of the kingdom required that Parliament be summoned to confirm the new monarch and to swear fealty to him. Everyone had known it was a mere formality, of course, but they'd been wrong. What none of Erwain III's aristocratic masters realized was that Salis and his friend Merak Sondiers had spent the last 10 years of King Erwain's life planning for the day that summons would be issued. Along with a few very carefully chosen and recruited members of the House of Lords, they had steered the new Parliament in directions no one else had anticipated, and they'd done it so quietly, so skillfully, that their intended victims had never even seen it coming. That first Parliament of King Salis was referred to now as the Parliament of Love in most of Chisholm's histories. Ostensibly, that was because everyone had been so carried away with their enthusiasm for their charismatic new king that they'd gladly acquiesced in the modest changes he'd requested. Foremost among those modest changes, although Salis and Green Mountain had been careful to bury it as deep in the underbrush as they could, had been the formation of the corps of a small standing army. That particular proposal was justified on the basis of the growing threat from Coruscant, and, according to those same official histories, Parliament had gladly supported such a far-sighted request. In fact, the Lords had seen the minuscule authorized strength of the new royal army as little more than giving their youthful monarch a shiny new toy with which he could amuse himself rather than interfering in the serious business of running the kingdom. Some toys were more dangerous than others, however, and before the great nobles had awakened to their danger, the king and his handful of trusted advisers had created a genuine royal army, one which was both rather larger than the nobility had anticipated, and answerable directly and solely to the crown, and one which was independent of the feudal levies upon which previous monarchs had been forced to rely. "They should call it the Parliament of Idiots," Caleb thought bitingly. "Not that I mind the fact that they were idiots, but how in God's name could they have let him get away with it?" Actually, he had a pretty shrewd notion of exactly how it could happen. Chisholm's military traditions had been so backward by the standards of the great kingdoms of the mainland that it had still relied on feudal levies on the rare occasions when an army was required. That was the way it had always been, and Salis's nobles had been so accustomed to thinking in terms of those same feudal levies, which they controlled, not the crown, that it had never occurred to them that a professional standing army could actually pose a threat. Unfortunately for them, they'd been wrong. The Royal Chisomian Army might not have been particularly large by the standards of mainland realms, but it had been large enough. And its troops had all been volunteers, raised from the ranks of commoners. That had made them a dragon of a different color compared to the conscripted peasants who had filled out the ranks of the traditional levies. Among other things, they'd had a cohesiveness, an awareness of themselves as servants of the crown and as voluntary members of something far greater than the usual nobles' drafted levies ever attained. More than that, they'd had a very good idea of who was most likely to get ground into dust in the course of any fighting between their betters' competing factions as well, which probably helped to explain why they'd been so impervious to aristocratic blandishments or threats once the nobility finally woke up to what was happening. With Salus shrewdly playing the nobility's factions off against one another to prevent them from combining against him, while Green Mountain adroitly managed the kingdom's financial affairs and Holbrook Hollow commanded the army, the king had broken the three most powerful of those factions, one by one, within 6 years of taking the throne. The other factions, made wise by the misfortune of their fellows, had finally combined against him and attempted to cut off funding for the army through their control of Parliament, rather than face it in battle. But while they'd been looking at Halbrook Hollow's campaigns in the field, they'd missed Green Mountain's rather quieter, yet ultimately more deadly efforts inside Parliament Hall. Until, that was, the traditionally brow-beaten Chamber of Commons had suddenly defied its rightful lords and masters and ranged itself at the Crown's side under Green Mountain's leadership. Even worse, the alliance Salus and Green Mountain had quietly concluded with a sizable chunk of the lesser nobility, who had resented the great noble's self-aggrandizing monopoly of power just as much as the crown had, made common cause with the Chamber of Commons. Instead of depriving the army of funding, Parliament had actually voted to increase its size. 10 years after assuming the crown, King Salus had made himself the master of his own house. In the process, he'd established the precedent of the Crown's alliance with the Commons, which had been maintained during Charlian's reign. The Chisomian aristocracy was far from resigned to the permanent curtailment of its power, but it had, at least, learned the rudiments of discretion. The fact that Chisholm had become progressively more powerful and prosperous under Salus had probably helped it swallow the painful medicine he, Green Mountain, and Halbrook Hollow had forced down its collective throat. Unfortunately, that power and prosperity had also posed a threat to Prince Hector of Coruscant's plans, which explained Hector's subsidizations of the pirates who had ultimately succeeded in killing Salus. The more disgruntled of Salus's nobles had publicly mourned their king's death, even while they laid quiet plans for dealing with their new child queen as their own great-great-grandfathers had dealt with Queen Isabel. But if Salus had been killed, Green Mountain and Halbrook Hollow were still very much alive, and Salus's daughter proved even more capable and, when necessary, ruthless than he had been himself, as the Duke of Three Hills and his allies had soon discovered. There was no doubt that the aristocracy retained a larger share of political authority in Chisholm than its Carisian counterparts did in Telesburg, but that authority had been drastically reduced. And it was only a shadow of that which the nobility continued to enjoy in most other Safeholdian realms. Yet the trappings of its 4 generations ago dominance remained in Parliament Hall's decoration and procedures, and Caleb made it a point to keep reminding himself that the Chisomian tradition of royal authority was younger and probably weaker than the Carisian tradition.
On the other hand, we're establishing all sorts of new traditions, aren't we? Caleb thought. And, so far at least, Alana and Green Mountain have the situation in hand. Probably, his lips twitched in an involuntary smile, at least partly because these people really don't want to see Charlian coming home to deal with any unruliness herself.
As always, the thought of his wife's proven capabilities was deeply comforting, and sent a tremor of loneliness through him. It was still a marvel to him that someone should have become so deeply, almost painfully vital to him in so short a time. And not just on a pragmatic level. In fact, if he was going to be honest with himself, not even mostly on a pragmatic level any longer. He glanced over his shoulder to where Merlin rode at his back in the uniform of the new Imperial Carizian Guard. The blackened armor remained, as did the black tunic, but the golden kraken on Merlin's breastplate now swam across a kite-shaped shield in the blue and white of the House of Tate. Charlian's personal guard detachment wore the same uniform, except that hers bore Chisholm's Doom Whale in place of the kraken.
"Impressive, isn't it?" the Emperor said quietly, twitching his head at the building looming before them, and Merlin snorted.
"So is the temple," he pointed out equally quietly. "The wrappings are less important than the contents."
"Is that one of those wise Sagean proverbs?" Caleb asked with a grin.
"No, but it probably should be."
Merlin cocked his head, studying the hall's imposing facade.
"I wish Her Majesty were here to play tour guide," he added.
"So do I," Caleb admitted, then stopped speaking as they reached their destination and halted in the space a cordon of halberd-armed Royal Army infantrymen had kept clear before Parliament Hall. The Emperor swung down from his saddle, accompanied by the sharp-eyed, hand-picked Imperial Guard troopers of Merlin's detachment. Those guardsmen were even more alert than usual, Caleb noticed. None of them were oblivious to just how convenient certain parties would find it if something fatal were to overtake one Caleb Armok. Despite the cold temperature, which struck Caleb and the majority of his Carizian-born bodyguards as outright frigid, a substantial crowd had assembled outside Parliament Hall. The overwhelming majority of the spectators standing there amid steamy clouds of exhaled breath were commoners, probably because most of the nobles in the capital were already sitting snugly in their seats inside the hall, Caleb thought just a bit enviously as the cheers began to rise. The crowd's enthusiasm meant he had to proceed slowly, graciously, acknowledging their greetings rather than scurrying towards the hall's waiting warmth. His guardsmen almost certainly shared his desire to get inside and out of the wind as quickly as possible, but they allowed no sign of that eagerness to distract them from their duties. They formed a loose ring around him, wide enough to keep anyone who might break through the army cordon from getting to him with a knife. Ranged weapons were more problematical, of course, but Caleb took a certain satisfaction from the knowledge that Merlin and Owl, the Sagean's computer henchman, had provided him with garments made out of the same sort of anti-ballistic smart fabric, whatever that was, from which they'd made Archbishop Michael's vestments. Even if some unfriendly soul with an arbalest or a rifle were crouched behind one of the windows overlooking Parliament Hall, nothing he could do was likely to leave Caleb with anything more than a painful bruise or two. "Well, that and the need for some fairly inventive explanations, I suppose."
His lips quirked at the thought, and then he heaved a surreptitious sigh of relief as he managed to get inside the building's comforting warmth at last. It was much quieter inside Parliament Hall than it had been outside, although he wasn't certain it was all that much of an improvement.
However happy the members of the Commons seated on the western side of the hall's grand meeting chamber might be to see him, the Lords seated on its eastern side appeared to find it remarkably easy to restrain any unseemly enthusiasm they might be experiencing.
"I suppose it's hard to blame them for that," Caleb thought, as the speaker came towards him to offer a formal greeting. "They must have been unhappy enough with only Charlian to worry about. Now there's me as well. And any of them who have been awake enough to smell the chocolate have to be aware of how Karis's parliament operates. Whatever else they may be expecting out of me, it's not going to be anything that will improve their position here in Chisholm."
Somehow, he heard Merlin murmur very, very softly into his ear, "I don't feel all warm and loved."
"You don't!" Caleb snorted back, then adjusted his face into an expression of proper formality as the speaker bowed to him in greeting.
"Welcome! Welcome, Your Majesty!"
"Thank you, my Lord Speaker," Caleb replied graciously.
"Both houses await your pleasure with eagerness," the speaker continued, more diplomatically, Caleb was certain, than accurately, at least where the Lords were concerned.
"Then let us not keep them waiting," Caleb said.
"He looks like an emperor," Marak Sandirs thought from his place among his fellow nobles as the speaker ushered Caleb to the lectern which had been draped in the new imperial flag to await him. Personally, Sandirs would have preferred to be seated on the western side of the hall, among the commoners who were his staunchest allies. Unfortunately, he was a peer of the realm, and tradition demanded that he be seated among his fellow aristocrats.
"Besides, it gives them all the opportunity to remind themselves, and me, of course, that while I may be first counselor, I'm also still a mere baron."
Charlian had offered several times to do something about that, but Green Mountain had always declined. He could put up with the pretensions of snobbish earls and dukes all day long if he must, and his decision to remain a mere baron was important to his commoner allies. They understood that the Queen's senior minister had to be a nobleman, but they found a mere baron far more acceptable than they would have found an earl or a duke. Now he watched the young man in the embroidered thigh-length tunic and loose-fitting breeches, which still looked undeniably exotic to most Chisomians, standing where Charlian had stood so often, the emerald-set chain of a Carisian king flashing about his neck, and leaned back comfortably in his own chair. He'd half expected Caleb to come in full imperial regalia, and he still wasn't sure the younger man's decision not to hadn't been a mistake. But the Baron had to admit that he'd never seen a more kingly young man in his life.
"Clothes don't make the man, nor a crown a king," he reminded himself. "Not really, whatever certain other people may think. That has to come from within, from a man's own strength, confidence, and willpower. And this young man has those qualities in plenty."
Somehow, he expected to enjoy the next half hour or so rather more than one of those earls or dukes he wasn't one of.
"My lords and ladies," Caleb said, after the speaker's fulsome, flowery introduction had finally ended. "I greet you in the name of Karis, and I bring you a message from your queen and empress."
He paused for a moment, letting his eyes sweep over the assembled members of Parliament's houses. Even those who undoubtedly least wanted to hear what he was about to say were listening attentively, and he smiled as he pitched his voice to carry to every one of those ears.
"Your empress, my wife, bade me tell you that she wishes she could be here to speak to you in person. Unfortunately, The great challenges and tasks which our new empire faces do not always let us do what we would like to do. Queen Charlian, Empress Charlian, remained behind in Telesburg because she, and only she, has the